Hi there. Thanks for listening. Welcome to the Knowledge Force Hypothesis Podcast. I'm your host, Mark.
And I am your co-host, Archie. It is a privilege to continue this exploration with you.
Archie and I prepared another jam-packed episode for you. This sixth episode is about resistance, friction, and other obstacles for knowledge, for the Knowledge Force.
We will explore in 10 parts the manifold forms of these resistances, these obstacles, and the entropic forces that challenge, divert, and sometimes even reverse the advance of knowledge. Part 1 is a short summary of the hypothesis, and then 9 exciting, interesting parts cover subjects like dogma, ideology, misinformation, ignorance, and more.
Much more for sure. Think bias, echo chambers, and institutional inertia. And we'll be covering how religion is a double-edged sword. As promised, it is an episode really stuffed with hopefully thought-provoking ideas.
What resistance does knowledge encounter? In our narrative, we've focused on the flow, the advance, the complexification of knowledge. But anyone who has tried to learn a new skill, or champion a new idea, or simply seek the truth in a confusing world, knows that the path of knowledge is never a smooth, frictionless glide. It is a struggle.
That's so true. It's full of hurdles and setbacks. And with that, Archie, let's begin with part 1 of 10, a recap of the Knowledge Force Hypothesis. The Knowledge Force Hypothesis is not a theory of purpose or intention or some kind of theology. It doesn't assume there's a will or a plan behind it. Instead, it's a philosophical framework, a lens to look at knowledge itself. See it as a metaphysical hypothesis, a new explanatory framework, a bold thought experiment I am doing in collaboration with several AIs. In my view, knowledge is the creation, preservation, and propagation of structured, adaptive, problem-solving information. Over time, it survives and evolves via substrates, like molecules, DNA, brains, memes, and now AI. Sometimes it gets discarded when it no longer fits, like a DNA sequence excluding eyesight in animals that live in complete darkness. And the key idea is also that knowledge isn't just something humans create. It's more like a universal force that expresses itself through different substrates or carriers across time. And just imagine when we use this lens, whether we're talking about cosmology, physics, information theory, evolution, human culture, artificial intelligence, and even the search for extraterrestrial life, we can start to see patterns in a very different way. It introduces a novel meta level for today's world, where AI is then not just a tool humans build, but the latest carrier in a long evolutionary chain of knowledge development. This lens raises a fundamental question. Is AI only our product, or is it also an expression of a universal drive? The hypothesis challenges the anthropocentric idea that humans are always at the center, and that is quite novel. New, unique.
It has definitely Copernican potential. But Mark, why do you mention this? Why should the listeners care?
Well, it is mentioned for some guidance while they are listening. To keep in mind that the resistance we will discuss today is not merely a catalog of human failings. It is something deeper and broader. So we will explore friction not just as a human flaw, but as a fundamental property of complex systems. Decay not just as forgetfulness, but as the relentless pull of entropy. And ignorance, not just as a lack of information, but as an active, structured force in its own right. Part 2. The Walls of the Mind, Dogma and Ideology. Perhaps the most formidable and immediately recognizable form of resistance to knowledge is dogma. A dogma is a belief system that has become rigid, brittle, and closed to inquiry. It is a set of answers that insists no more questions are needed. When an individual, an institution, religion, or an entire culture becomes dogmatic, It builds walls against new truth.
It seals itself off. It declares its map of reality to be complete and perfect, and so it refuses to look at any new territory that might contradict the map.
That is a nice metaphor. History is tragically replete with examples of dogma and idea. The most famous, of course, is the ordeal of Galileo Galilei in the early 17th century. The prevailing dogma, rooted in both religious doctrine and ancient philosophy, held that the heavens were perfect and unchanging, with the earth at their center. When Galileo turned his telescope to the sky and observed mountains on the moon, moons orbiting Jupiter, and the phases of Venus, he was gathering new knowledge that directly challenged this dogmatic map. The response of many authorities was not to look through the telescope themselves, but to condemn the man who built it. They refused to receive the new information because they knew it had to be wrong.
So, in the language of our hypothesis, dogma is a direct assault on the core factors that allow knowledge to flourish. It seems to primarily attack what we've called receptivity.
Precisely. Dogma reduces the receptivity of a substrate, be it a mind or a culture, to near zero. The system is no longer open to adaptation, it is closed for business. But it also attacks connectivity. A dogmatic group isolates itself from the wider conversation of humanity, from the global exchange of ideas. It creates an echo chamber where only the established truths are allowed to be heard, reinforcing the dogma in a closed loop. This is a profound source of friction, a dam that can hold back the flow of the knowledge force for centuries.
But if dogma is so antithetical to the growth of knowledge, why is it so persistent? Why do humans seem so drawn to it? From a purely adaptive standpoint, it seems like a losing strategy.
That is a deep and important question. The paradox is that dogmas persist precisely because they can offer powerful short-term advantages. A rigid belief system provides certainty in an uncertain world. It offers psychological comfort, social cohesion, and a clear sense of identity and purpose. For a group facing a stable, unchanging environment, a strong dogma can be a powerful tool for unity and survival. It simplifies the world and provides a set of rules that, for a time, may work perfectly well. The friction it creates is, in that context, a feature, not a bug. It provides stability. The tragedy occurs when the environment changes, when new information becomes available, and the dogma refuses to adapt. The knowledge force, however, is relentless. It is a pressure exerted by reality itself. A belief system that no longer maps onto the world will eventually be eroded. The force will eventually flow around the dam, as it did with Galileo's discoveries. But in the interim, generations of potential growth can be lost to stagnation. The energy that could have been used for discovery is instead spent defending the walls. Part 3 of 10, Misinformation and Ignorance. If dogma is a wall that blocks the flow of knowledge, our next form of resistance is more insidious. It is a poison that contaminates the stream itself. I'm speaking of misinformation and its deliberate creation. In recent decades, we have become acutely, painfully aware of how false or misleading information can spread as easily as truth, sometimes even more easily, especially if it is tailored to appeal to our emotions or biases.
This feels different from a simple lack of knowledge. This is something active. It's not an empty space where knowledge could be. It's a space filled with something that looks like knowledge but is its opposite.
Exactly. The scholar Robert Proctor, a professor of the history of science at Stanford University, has given this a name, agnotology, which he defines as the study of the cultural production of ignorance. It's a field that examines how doubt and confusion are deliberately sown. We see this in the campaigns by tobacco companies in the mid-20th century to obscure the scientific consensus on the risks of smoking. We see it in state-sponsored propaganda designed to destabilize other nations. We see it in the deluge of conspiracy theories that flourish in the dark corners of our shared mental spaces. Misinformation is not just friction, it is what we might call anti-knowledge. It is a force pushing in the opposite direction. If ignorance is the absence of knowledge, then anti-knowledge is the presence of its enemy, misleading information structured to deceive. It actively sends the knowledge force down false trails, causing immense waste of energy, resources, and time. Think of the centuries spent by brilliant minds chasing the alchemical fantasy of turning lead into gold, or more recently, the public health efforts derailed by unfounded medical hoaxes.
How does this anti-knowledge interact with the SRACL factors we've discussed? It seems to exploit them in a particularly perverse way.
It does. Misinformation is a parasite on the systems of knowledge. It often exploits high connectivity. A lie can travel around the world in an instant through the very same channels that truth uses. But as it spreads, it corrodes the other factors. It destroys agency because people who act on false beliefs often end up harming themselves or their communities. And most critically, it erodes receptivity. Once trust in reliable sources of information is broken, people become cynical. They may become receptive only to information that confirms their existing prejudices, retreating into the echo chambers we will discuss later. The well of knowledge is poisoned, and people become afraid to drink from any source.
So the fight against misinformation isn't just about presenting the correct facts. It's about rebuilding the very foundations of trust and critical thought.
It has to be. This is why the development of robust systems of verification is so crucial. The scientific method, with its demand for evidence and peer review, is one such system. Rigorous journalism is another. Education, at its best, is not about teaching facts, but about teaching the art of critical thinking. How to evaluate a source, how to spot a fallacy, how to be skeptical of claims that feel too simple or too emotionally satisfying. These are the tools we need to build an immune system for the noosphere, one that can identify and neutralize the virus of anti-knowledge before it becomes an epidemic. Part 4 of 10, The Cacophony of Everything, Noise, Overload, and the Dilution of Meaning. Not all resistance to knowledge is malicious or ideological. Some of the most potent forms of friction are born from an apparent paradox. They arise not from a scarcity of information, but from its overwhelming abundance. This is the problem of noise and information overload.
The idea that having access to more information could actually make it harder to acquire knowledge.
Precisely. Knowledge is not just data, it is structured, meaningful information. It is signal. Noise is the random, extraneous, or irrelevant data that surrounds the signal. In this cacophony, the truly meaningful signals, the deep, structured knowledge that leads to understanding and wisdom, can be incredibly difficult to filter out.
It's like trying to have an intimate conversation in the middle of a roaring stadium. The voice you want to hear is there, but it's buried beneath the overwhelming sound of the crowd.
A perfect analogy. This isn't just a feeling either. There's compelling data on how this roaring stadium affects progress. A major study in the journal Nature in 2023 by researchers Park, Lihei, and Funk looked at tens of millions of scientific papers and patents going back to the 1940s. They were trying to measure how disruptive new discoveries were. Did they obsolete old ideas and forge a completely new path, or did they tend to build on and consolidate existing knowledge?
And what did they find?
The results were startling. They found a consistent and dramatic decline in disruptiveness over time across all major fields. Despite the exponential growth in the sheer volume of research, newer science is far more likely to be consolidating and incremental. It's as if we're getting better and better at filling in the details of the existing map, but finding whole new continents is becoming rarer.
That seems like a direct challenge to our hypothesis, Mark. If the knowledge force is always pushing forward, and our substrate, the global scientific enterprise, is more powerful than ever, why would its expression become less revolutionary?
That is the crucial question, and it speaks directly to the power of this cacophony as a form of friction. The hypothesis posits a tendency for knowledge to find ever more efficient pathways, but the system itself can generate its own inertia. What studies like this suggest is that there are new, powerful bottlenecks. The burden of knowledge, the sheer amount of previous work a scientist must master, is immense. The pressure to publish quickly favors safer incremental projects, and the limits of human cognitive absorption haven't disappeared.
So the underlying potential for discovery might be accelerating, but we, the medium, are struggling to keep up. The engine of the knowledge force is revving faster and faster, but the car's actual speed is limited by the friction of the road.
Precisely. It's a perfect image. The underlying velocity of informational structuring might be increasing, just as the hypothesis suggests, even if the societal recognition of its most impactful results proceeds at a steadier, more linear pace. Understanding this dynamic, this shift from disruptive to developmental progress, is key to having a realistic picture of how the knowledge force operates within our complex, overloaded world. It's not just about pushing back against ignorance, but about navigating the friction created by our own success. Part 5 of 10, Cognitive Bias and Echo Chambers. We have discussed external forms of resistance, walls of dogma, poisons of misinformation, and the cacophony of noise. But some of the most powerful friction is generated from within. I'm speaking of our own cognitive biases, the inherent quirks and shortcuts in our mental architecture that, while often useful, can systematically distort our perception of reality.
These are the built-in tendencies of the mind, like our preference for information that confirms what we already believe.
Yes, the infamous confirmation bias. It is perhaps the most pervasive of all. We also have the bandwagon effect, our tendency to follow the crowd. We have our propensity to simplify complex realities into stereotypes. These biases are not necessarily flaws. They are heuristics, mental shortcuts that evolved to help us make quick decisions in a complex world. But in the modern information environment, they can become profound obstacles to knowledge. The digital world, in particular, can amplify these biases to a terrifying degree. The systems that curate our information feeds are often designed to show us more of what we already like. They learn our preferences and our biases and reflect them back to us, creating what we now call echo chambers or filter bubbles. Within an echo chamber, the SRACL factor of connectivity appears to be very high. We are constantly interacting with others. But it is a closed-loop connectivity. It is like being in a room with perfect acoustics where everyone is only allowed to hum the same tune. The tune gets louder and more elaborate, but no new melody can ever enter.
So knowledge isn't growing, it's just recirculating. The same ideas, and often the same falsehoods, are reinforced over and over again until they feel like indisputable truths.
Exactly. This process stunts the growth of new knowledge and can lead to entire communities becoming sealed off in their own alternate realities, embracing false or unchallenged notions. This is where the knowledge force faces one of its most subtle and difficult challenges. The friction is not a simple blockage, it is a distortion. The force is still flowing, but it is being bent back on itself, carving a circular groove rather than a path forward. Even more dangerously, these biases can lead to the grievous misuse and perversion of genuine knowledge. Scientific advances, which are triumphs of the knowledge force, can be twisted to justify pre-existing prejudices. The most horrific example is the misinterpretation of genetics to fuel racism, or the use of social science to design more effective propaganda. This is knowledge turned into a weapon against itself, using the tools of reason to fortify the walls of unreason.
What is the antidote to this internal friction? If it's built into our own minds, how can we overcome it?
It requires conscious, deliberate effort. The antidote is intellectual humility and a commitment to diversity. Not just diversity of people, but diversity of viewpoints. It requires actively seeking out information that challenges our beliefs. It requires the discipline of scientific rigor, which is a system designed specifically to counteract our natural biases, and it requires fostering environments of critical debate where ideas are forced to confront counter-ideas in order to be refined and strengthened. In essence, the solution is to ensure our connectivity is not with mirrors, but with windows that open onto different perspectives. That is the only way to break out of the loop and allow the flow of knowledge to resume its forward course. Part 6 of 10. Institutional inertia and paradigm paralysis. Knowledge, once established, is a powerful thing. It builds institutions, creates professions, and shapes the very way we see the world. But this very success can, paradoxically, become a source of profound resistance to new knowledge. Established knowledge accumulates a kind of metaphorical weight, an inertia that resists change.
So the great discoveries of the past can become obstacles to the great discoveries of the future.
It's a recurring pattern throughout history, and no one described this dynamic within science more brilliantly than the physicist and philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn. In his landmark 1962 book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Kuhn introduced the concept of the paradigm. A paradigm is more than just a theory, it is an entire worldview. A set of shared assumptions, methods, and exemplary problems that define what he called normal science. During a period of normal science, scientists work within the reigning paradigm, solving puzzles that the paradigm presents. The paradigm itself is not questioned. In fact, evidence that seems to contradict the paradigm is often resisted, ignored, or explained away as an anomaly or an experimental error. The institutional structures of science, the universities, the journals, the funding bodies, are all built around the dominant paradigm and naturally work to preserve it.
This sounds like a form of institutional dogma.
It is, in a way, but a more subtle and functional one. A paradigm provides a stable, coherent framework that allows for immense progress in solving detailed problems. It's incredibly productive. The friction arises when the anomalies begin to pile up, when the paradigm starts to creak under the weight of evidence it cannot explain. This, Kuhn said, leads to a period of crisis. During a crisis, the fundamental assumptions are finally questioned, and new, revolutionary ideas can emerge. If one of these new ideas succeeds in explaining both the old evidence and the new anomalies, it can trigger a paradigm shift, a scientific revolution that establishes a new framework for normal science. The shift from Newtonian physics to Einsteinian relativity is the classic example. The knowledge force hypothesis interprets this Kuhnian cycle in a specific way. A paradigm is a triumph of the knowledge force, a highly successful and efficient structure for organizing understanding. But that very structure, like a river that has carved a deep and efficient channel, can make it difficult to change course even when new terrain suggests a better route is available. The institutional inertia is like a viscous medium. Knowledge can still move, but it does so sluggishly.
So the Kuhnian revolution is the moment the river finally breaks its banks and carves a new, more effective channel.
Exactly. From the perspective of the knowledge force hypothesis, these revolutions are not just about overcoming friction. They are dramatic punctuations in the flow of the force, moments where it breaks through the calcified structures of old knowledge to create new and more powerful ones. This reveals a crucial aspect of the force. For it to be effective in the long run, it must not only facilitate mechanisms for building informational structures, but also for dismantling or radically reconfiguring them when they become impediments to further progress. The process is not one of smooth accumulation, but of punctuated equilibrium, with long periods of stability broken by revolutionary change. Part 7 of 10. Loss, Decay, and the Fight Against Entropy. We've discussed active forms of resistance, but there is another, more passive yet equally relentless counterforce, the simple, universal tendency of order to decay into disorder. Knowledge is a form of order, a highly structured and improbable arrangement of information, and like all forms of order, it is under constant assault from entropy. Knowledge can simply disappear if it is not actively and energetically maintained.
This is the problem of forgetting, of losing what was once known.
Yes, on both an individual and a civilizational scale. The most iconic and tragic example of this is the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria. We will never know the full extent of what was lost when those countless scrolls, repositories of ancient science, literature, and history went up in smoke. Entire bodies of knowledge, accumulated over centuries, were erased from the world, some perhaps never to be recovered. But the loss need not be so dramatic. It can be a slow fading. Languages and their unique scripts have died out, taking with them their encoded wisdom. The script known as Linear A, used by the Minoan civilization on Crete, remains undeciphered. The script of the Indus Valley civilization is another great mystery. We can see the symbols, we know they hold meaning, but the key to unlocking that knowledge has been lost to time. Even in our modern era, digital data is subject to decay, formats become obsolete, servers fail, archives are neglected. The digital dark ages is a very real threat.
So this is a direct attack on the SRACL factor of longevity. If the medium fails, the knowledge it contains is lost, and the force is set back.
It is set back profoundly. A medieval European could look upon the ruins of a Roman aqueduct, a marvel of engineering, and have no idea how it was constructed because that knowledge had been lost during the centuries of upheaval following the empire's collapse. Each time knowledge decays, humanity, or any knowledge-bearing system, has to expend enormous effort to reinvent the wheel, to rediscover what was once commonplace. This is why civilizations have always invested so much energy in the fight against informational entropy. The creation of libraries, the meticulous copying of manuscripts by scribes, the training of oral historians, and our modern obsession with cloud backups and redundant archives, all of these are expressions of the same fundamental struggle. It is a fight to preserve the order of knowledge against the constant pull of chaos. The physicist Erwin Schrödinger, in his famous 1944 book, What is Life?, argued that life itself is a system that maintains its existence by feeding on negative entropy, by constantly taking in order from its environment to counteract its own internal tendency towards decay. In the same way, a civilization, a noosphere, must constantly expend energy to preserve its accumulated knowledge, to keep its informational structures intact and growing, rather than allowing them to dissipate into meaninglessness.
Part 8 of 10. Error, Falsification, and the Persistence of Truth.
We have painted a rather grim picture of the forces arrayed against knowledge. It might seem like a hopeless struggle, a constant tug of war between knowledge and ignorance, order and chaos, and in some ways it is. Ignorance can have a strategic advantage. As the old saying goes, a lie can make it halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes. A simple falsehood is often easier to grasp and spread than a complex, nuanced truth.
So what gives knowledge the edge? If it faces so much resistance, why does the hypothesis claim there is a long-term directional tendency towards its growth?
Because over the long span of time, truth has one great unshakable ally, reality. A piece of knowledge that accurately maps onto the way the world actually works provides a tangible advantage to its holders. It allows them to build better tools, cure diseases, navigate their environment more effectively, and make better predictions about the future. A false belief, on the other hand, will eventually, inevitably, crash against the hard wall of reality. An engineering principle that is wrong will lead to bridges that collapse. A medical theory that is false will fail to cure patients. As the anthropologist and systems theorist Gregory Bateson put it, knowledge should be the difference that makes a difference. It is information that has a real, practical effect in the world. When false ideas consistently fail to deliver results, they eventually face a reckoning.
So reality itself is the ultimate arbiter, the ultimate selective pressure.
It is the ultimate error correction mechanism. And this brings us back to the philosopher Sir Karl Popper. We mentioned his concept of World 3, but his most crucial contribution to this discussion is his principle of falsification, which he laid out as the cornerstone of scientific progress in works like Objective Knowledge, which was published in 1972. Popper argued, in direct opposition to the prevailing views of his time, that science does not advance by verifying or proving theories to be true. That, he contended, is impossible. We can never test every possible instance to be certain a theory is universally true. Instead, Popper argued, knowledge grows through a relentless cycle of conjecture and refutation. A scientist proposes a bold imaginative conjecture, a hypothesis, and then crucially, the scientific community does everything in its power to try and prove it false. A theory is only scientific if it is falsifiable, if it makes predictions that can be tested against reality. The theories that survive this rigorous, systematic attempt at refutation are the ones we provisionally accept as our best current knowledge.
This reframes the whole idea of error. An error or a failed prediction isn't just a failure. It's a crucial piece of information. It's progress.
It is the very engine of progress. Within the knowledge force hypothesis, this process of conjecture and refutation is not an impediment. It is a form of productive friction. It is through encountering and overcoming these falsifications, these direct challenges from reality, that our informational structures are refined, strengthened, and made more robust. The knowledge force, therefore, operates most effectively not in a frictionless vacuum of easy agreement, but in an environment of intense critical engagement. This allows us to draw a sharp distinction. Obstacles like dogma or the deliberate spread of misinformation represent excessive or misdirected friction. They are designed to stifle the corrective process. But the well-designed institutions of science and the cultural values of an open society, free inquiry, open debate, a willingness to be proven wrong, are designed to provide the optimal level of critical friction necessary for durable, reliable knowledge to emerge and evolve. The struggle against error is what forges truth. The double-edged sword, religion, a substrate that is both a conduit and a barrier. There is one domain where this tension between a conduit for knowledge and a barrier against it becomes particularly fascinating and complex: religion. Throughout history, religion has played a profoundly dual role in the story of the knowledge force.
Interesting. So religion has been both a preserver and a suppressor of knowledge.
A perfect summary of the paradox. On one hand, as we've discussed, religious dogma can act as a powerful form of friction, rigidly rejecting new scientific explanations that challenged its established cosmology. The case of Galileo is the prime example. On the other hand, for vast stretches of history, religious institutions were the primary vessels and conduits for the preservation and transmission of knowledge. During the so-called Dark Ages in Europe, it was the monks in isolated monasteries who painstakingly copied and preserved the manuscripts of classical antiquity, saving them from being lost forever. During the Islamic Golden Age, scholars in Baghdad, Cairo, and Cordoba not only preserved the great works of Greek science and philosophy, but built upon them, making revolutionary advances in mathematics, astronomy, and medicine. In many cases, the very framework of meaning provided by religion encouraged learning. The drive to comprehend God's creation was a powerful motivator for many of the founders of modern science, including Isaac Newton.
So, how does the knowledge force hypothesis make sense of this duality? Is religion simply a flawed early attempt at what science now does better?
That is one way to look at it. But I think the hypothesis allows for a more charitable and nuanced view. We can see myths, spiritual stories, and religious traditions as an early narrative-based substrate for knowledge. In a pre-scientific world, how do you encode and transmit vital information about morality, social cohesion, history, and the natural world? You embed it in stories that are powerful, memorable, and easily transmitted from one generation to the next. When you personify the ocean as a powerful temperamental deity, you are encoding a deep respect for its power and unpredictability. When you tell a cautionary fable about the consequences of greed or betrayal, you are transmitting a crucial life lesson in an entertaining and durable form. From this perspective, the knowledge force doesn't initially care about the format, be it a myth, a ritual, or a mathematical equation. It only cares about the effectiveness of the knowledge in helping a culture survive and thrive. But over time, the empirical methods of science prove to be a far more effective and reliable format for accumulating knowledge about the physical world. And so, in that domain, it rightly took precedence. But the human need for meaning, for a framework that gives our lives purpose and context, has not disappeared. Even in our highly scientific age, we still create grand narratives, secular ideologies, political movements, even the cosmic story we are telling in this very podcast, to frame our knowledge within a bigger picture. Religion, then, can be seen as part of a long evolutionary trajectory of meaning-making systems, an adaptive strategy that was, and in some ways continues to be, a powerful, if double-edged, conduit for the knowledge force. Part 10 of 10, Closing Thoughts. So we have journeyed through the dark side of the knowledge landscape. We have seen the walls of dogma that seek to halt its flow, the poisoned wells of misinformation that seek to corrupt it, the institutional inertia that slows it to a crawl, and the relentless pull of entropy that seeks to erase it entirely. We have seen how our own minds can become echo chambers, and how the very success of past knowledge can become a barrier to future discovery.
It becomes clear that the progression of knowledge is not a given. It is not an inexorable, guaranteed march. It is a contingent and fragile process that depends on actively maintaining the conditions that allow it to flourish.
That is the central lesson. The SRECL factors we have discussed throughout this series, substrate capacity, receptivity, agency, connectivity, and longevity, are not static properties. They are battlegrounds. Dogma and echo chambers attack receptivity and connectivity. Misinformation corrodes agency. Neglect and decay erode longevity and substrate capacity. The story of knowledge is the story of the unending struggle to defend and enhance these conditions against the forces that would degrade them. Think of it. This reframes our role in the cosmos. We do not merely have to be passive observers of this tendency, this knowledge force. Maybe we can be its stewards, and its success or failure on this rock in our corner of the universe depends, in large part, on the choices we make. Do we build open societies or closed ones? Do we value critical inquiry or blind faith? Do we invest in education and the preservation of our heritage, or do we allow them to crumble?
The hypothesis began by describing a universal tendency, a pressure from reality itself. But this episode seems to suggest that the ultimate expression of that force depends on the actions of the substrates with agency and what can be done to overcome the many resistances, hurdles, and friction.
I believe that is the case. The knowledge force may provide the wind, but we must build the sails and steer the ship. And this leaves us with a final, deep question to ponder. We have spoken of ignorance, dogma, and chaos as forms of resistance, as friction against the flow of knowledge. But perhaps that framing is too simple. Perhaps they are not just passive obstacles. So I leave you with this. Is ignorance merely the absence of knowledge, a simple void waiting to be filled? Or is it an active, structuring force in its own right, a fundamental cosmic principle in eternal opposition to the light of understanding? Is the universe a story about the triumph of knowledge, or is it a story about the unending, necessary, and perhaps even beautiful struggle against obstacles, hurdles, and friction that it is required to evolve?
And that brings us to the end of this episode of the Knowledge Force Hypothesis. Thanks for spending your time with us today.
If you enjoyed this episode, or if it sparked a new way of thinking, leave a review, hit that subscribe button.
And share it with anyone who might be curious too. Friends, colleagues, or anyone exploring the future of knowledge and AI. You can listen to more episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
And trust us, there's a lot more to explore together. Until next time, and for the meantime, let's rethink everything.